In this video, we are going to be talking about the 1955 film Night of the Hunter, which was directed by Charles Laughton. It was the only film he ever directed. And it starred Robert Mitchum, Shelley Winters, and it has some wonderful performances by a really young cast, Sally Jane Bruce and Billy Chapin. My guest today is Eric Marchand, who is a film critic and is the host of Cinema Scene, which you can see on Rogers Television in Durham. And he has a podcast as well called the Untitled Movie Podcast. I'm really excited to talk to Eric today about this film. So Eric, welcome. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Robert, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it. And I'm really excited to talk about a genre-themed film for the month of October.
Exactly. Yeah, and this certainly has a horror feel to it, and creepy Big Bad Wolf, certainly. Just before we jump into it, I listened to some of your podcasts, which I really enjoyed. And what is the podcast essentially about? Is it pure film reviews, or is it a looser format?
Well, first of all, let me apologize to you for taking that time to do that. I always like saying that and making that joke that, you know, Matt and I, who's the co-host, Matt Rohrbeck of Untitled Movie Podcast, we're always grateful to anybody who listens even for 5 minutes. And we're always surprised that somebody is listening for even 5 minutes. So thank you for even doing that.
No, my pleasure.
Untitled Movie Podcast and Untitled Movie Reviews and Untitled Movie Conversations is kind of this network of podcasts where we review films and interview people that are in the industry. And then Untitled Movie Podcast itself, which is the flagship show, is usually an hour, 2 hours, probably even longer, of two guys that really love movies just talking about movies. And it's mostly sort of based on sort of what's going on a week to week basis. We've kind of slowed down a little bit during the pandemic, but we have kind of gotten back on track and doing sort of weekly episodes. But again, they go long, and it's just two guys that have been best friends for, you know, 11 years now, talking about movies. And just, you know, we do this, Matt and I just do this off air, and we're just like, well, why don't we record this and see if anybody else wants to listen?
Yeah,
because we would be doing it anyways. So that's basically it.
Yeah, I think a lot of podcasts, from my experience, they start that way. It's like, you know, we're talking so much about whatever the topic is, why don't we put it out there and see if it interests anyone. But no, that's great. So this film, you know, every time I do a review on something that people often qualify as a film noir, you always get some people who feel that it's not, or some feel that it is, or some feel that it partially is. Do you think that, would you put this in the film noir genre?
That's a good question. I was thinking about that watching it again this weekend. And, you know, Charles Laughton, the going back to first him, you know, being an actor turned director, right. The joke was with this movie for a lot of film critics and people is that he is the perfect director, you know, the one and done. He said everything he needed to do with one movie and made the perfect film and never made another movie after that. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the film noir aspect, it very much has those aspects integrated in there. It's a very sort of dark film, tonally speaking. But what I really appreciated watching it this time around, it's a hard film to pin down as just one thing.
Yeah.
At times it does feel like a film noir, but then at other times it also has gothic horror elements to it and German expressionism with the lighting and the way that sort of the production design is sort of shaped, especially with the cellar and the bedrooms. Like you look at the kind of almost triangular shape of those rooms, right?
Yeah.
And then it becomes a kids in peril latchkey kid kind of movie as well. And then there are some weird sprinkles of sort of morbid humor. So it's weird that it's not just one movie within one genre. And those are the films that I love the most because they're the most hard to sort of articulate what they are, but they're the most rewarding because they're not just one thing. And when you're watching it, it continually changes shape as you go along, or go up river in this case, and, you know, find the story as it goes along, because when you see those first images of Robert Mitchum as this preacher, you automatically think how iconic he is, you know, with the love hate, you know, tattoos. I mean, you even think of it with, you know, Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing with Rahim, Bill Nunn's character, with the rings that are the same. And then like the movie I was weirdly thinking of when I was watching this again was Poltergeist 2 and how much that stole from it. The Julian Beck character in that movie singing God is in his holy temple, the way that Robert Mitchum sings all of his sort of religious hymns. But yeah, it's just hard to kind of pinpoint one specific genre, but there is definitely a lot of film noir in there. It's just, I wouldn't necessarily categorize it as just film noir.
Yeah, no, I agree, you know, because I was, you know, I don't know if you ever watch Eddie Mueller, who's like the Noir Alley TCM host, and he has this fun series called Noir or Not, and I do it as part of for my Patreon members as well. But he has one on this, and he says, well, it's fairy tale noir, and I know what he means, because it has this children's fairy tale feel to it, and story, like a family film almost, but not quite. But then again, in terms of the content, the preacher played by Mitchum is totally motivated by money at all costs, and that means murder is no problem for him, and that is very much a noir thing. You often see that very much happening in a lot of noirs after World War II, is those characters who would do anything to make a buck. And I really appreciated that aspect of it being noir. And then at the same time, when we're looking at who is the quote unquote femme fatale, I mean, some people feel like, well, you can't have a noir without a femme fatale. I don't necessarily feel that way, but I think in a way he also is the femme fatale, because he talks about the Adam and Eve story as the you know, the devil who got Eve to eat the apple, but he very much is the devil. He's seducing everybody with his charm. You know, all the women, like, they are falling for him. Even those, one of those young orphan girls who live with the two kids towards the end. Ruby has a fascination for him, and you know, he's just easily can seduce. So those two things alone, for me, I always look at if it has the money motivation, and it has some sort of seduction, some sort of aspect of someone up, you know, using sexuality as a way to get what they want. I can certainly put it there, but I totally agree with you that it is not pure noir. You know, not at all. What would you say is there a through line here in your books? Is there an essence to this story? If you had to sum it up as some sort of spine to this film?
Yeah, I wanted to just go on something though that you mentioned there with the duality of Robert Mitchum's Harry Powell, is that that's really interesting that you talked about that, because early on when we see him, the one thing that he does feel like, you have a character who's presenting himself as moral, but anything and everything that he does throughout is amoral. Right. And so we see him early on at a burlesque show. And the thing that I was kind of taken aback by watching it this time is how self-loathing he is as a character, and repressing his own sort of desires or thoughts, and thinking, okay, well, this is, you know, not Christian. But as we come to know him and see what he's capable of, everything he does is hypocrisy. You know, he is a character that is completely going against the teachings. And then later, when, you know, the Lillian Gish character is introduced, we see the actual version of somebody who takes the Christian scriptures and teachings and is, you know, the juxtaposition of what Harry is. And I feel that, like, that is fascinating in itself, that this guy, as you mentioned, you know, he's very charming. He is able to seduce the adults for the most part, other than when we get to that final act. But another thing with that, when he is kind of charming Ruby, it weirdly also reminded me of Robert De Niro as Max Caddy.
I was thinking that as well.
Juliet Lewis, which is also funny because Robert Mitchum played Max Caddy in the original Cape Fear. So I wouldn't be surprised if, I mean, I know probably Scorsese's a fan, but I wouldn't be surprised if Robert De Niro, you know, took some pointers and looked at The Night of the Hunter as well, and not just the original version of Cape Fear. But in terms of a through line, I think what you mentioned with Eddie Mueller is that it does feel like a Grimm's fairy tale, especially when you get to the river sequence. Right. Up until that point, I would say it is the way that it looks in, again, sort of the dark shadows, but with the kind of strong pointed lighting, it does have this fairy tale quality. And I think that that works because it's from, or it's told mostly from the child's point of view. Yeah. Even that opening scene where we have the children listening to, you know, the bedtime story, the Christian story from Lillian Gish, it weirdly also reminded me of like David Lynch a little bit, where you see the wholesome side of, you know, the Midwest, Western America, and just under the surface is all the horror and terror that lies there, and especially the desperation that lurks just beyond sort of, you know, the door where, you know, this takes place during the Great Depression. So you have characters that are willing to do whatever is necessary in order to survive. And even the Peter Graves character, Ben Harper, who's the father who's arrested, goes to jail and is hung at the beginning of the film. He's also kind of, you could put him in the category of being almost a femme fatale. He's not necessarily completely seduced by Robert Mitchum the way that Shelley Winters and, you know, the Spoons who run the local ice cream parlor are. But you kind of feel that they, you know, all are susceptible, where at least, you know, John, the son, you know, is on to him right away. And he's kind of trying to keep that promise that he made to his father. So I would say that it's a film very much, the through line is desperation and survival. And I think that that's something that keeps coming up time and time again.
Yeah, no, well said. I completely agree. And I also really felt that this aspect of children being able to like endure and that they're, the strength of character that you see in the young children, and at the end, the women, you know, the woman that's been taking care of them mentions that in that Christmas scene, you know, love of children, that children can endure. And I think, you know, it's true, because I suppose I've seen that with kids. They have a certain, I don't know if it's necessarily because perhaps they're so young, so they don't have a lot of years of experience. So whatever is at them, they don't see any other alternative but to go to face it, which you very much see with John. Now, John is a character who maybe years later, it's going to affect him as an adult as things get more complicated and hard, as we know. But I thought that was such a beautiful message, and so kind of respectful and pro children, because a lot of the adults don't believe these kids. I mean, you know, he says, you know, don't trust this man, you know, and the mother doesn't believe them, that Shelley Winters doesn't believe John when he says, you know, he's looking for the money, and she immediately accuses him of lying. But of course, the woman that is taking care of them at the end, played Lillian Gish.
Yeah.
Rachel Cooper, she believes him, you know, and thank God for that. So I just thought that was really a spectacular thing that I don't see as much in films. I don't know how you felt about that.
It used to be a common trope where, you know, the parents didn't believe the kids.
Yeah.
You know, when we were growing up.
The Big Bad Wolf.
Yeah. Like you saw it a lot in like, you know, 70s and 80s horror films specifically, where, you know, the kids will tell the parents that there's a monster in the closet, but they don't believe them. And it's there, you know, it's like that classic kind of, you know, the kids can't turn to anybody, and so the only people that they have is themselves. And another movie, weirdly enough, that I was thinking about a little bit while watching this was, I wouldn't be surprised if either Stanley Kubrick or Stephen King, or maybe even both, sort of took inspiration in when they were writing or kind of adapting the Halloran character in The Shining, because Uncle Birdie kind of reminds me a little bit of Halloran, where he talks to John about being, you know, someone you can confide in. If there's ever any trouble, come to me. And the payoff of both of those scenes, while in The Night of the Hunter is less brutal than, you know, Scatman Crothers' last scene in The Shining, right, there's something there about ultimately being disappointed in somebody that you think you can rely on, you know, that's maybe not in your sort of direct family circle. And I think that that's also really fascinating as well, in terms of just that little moment. But yeah, it's overall, I would say, like, it's one of those films where, you know, you watch it and you can't help but be sort of taken back by, you know, Charles Laughton as a technician, as a sort of a director who, if he had gone on to direct other movies, I wonder what that could have sort of held, you know, because it does very much look like a silent film at times. I mean, hiring Lillian Gish, who is one of the biggest silent movie stars of all time, you know, for that role at the end, which is an amazing performance.
Oh, she's incredible.
Such a spitfire in this film. Is also very telling of the style of the movie, because I think, like, it's a very simplistic narrative of, you know, these two kids basically trying to sort of overcome a very malevolent force with Robert Mitchum. And Robert Mitchum himself, like a great actor who, you know, was one, I think, was Roger Ebert's favorite actor. He always would talk about him. But what I find really interesting also about his character is he almost does feel like a prototype for what you would get in the 70s and 80s with horror movie slashers. That character that just keeps on coming, that you can't escape, that you always think that, you know, you've finally gotten one or two steps away from, and then he's right there.
That's
just taking
point.
His time, you know. He's on horseback at one point where we see
him
sort of
so
on the
spooky
landscape. And he's just humming, you know, the sort of the main hymn, and you're just thinking to yourself, like, these kids cannot escape this guy, no matter how far they go.
Yeah, those moments were so spooky. I've actually had that hymn in my head all day. And I thought, you know, I actually should really mention something that I always forget to do, is always mentioning the other collaborators. And, you know, the cinematographer, Stanley Cortez, is incredible. I mean, oh my God. I mean, I know you mentioned the photography already, but is so perfect how he used light or not use light. I mean, often I was finding that inside the house, anytime you saw light, it was never on Mitchum, but it was always on the kids, but everything around them was darkness and they had just these corners. But Mitchum was always in complete, you know, darkness. And as you said, you know, when you first see him outside the window, but initially you see that shadow, It is so spooky. And that moment later that you're referring to, when they're sleeping in the barn and you just see him hymning and on the horse from a distance, I mean, wow. But it feels like you're going through a storybook, you know, like for kids, but in a positive way, like in a way that's just like, how did they come up with that?
But it's still a Grimm's fairy tale, which is kind of interesting. But then on top of that, you learn that it's also based on a true story, a true crime story, you know, based on this one guy that was hung in the early 1930s. And it's based on Davis Grubb's novel as well. So there's that aspect of it as well, where it's like, okay, so there is some truth to this almost like Hansel and Gretel-esque horror story that we're being told, where, you know, you look at something like this, where obviously, again, it's more fantastical than, say, like, you know, In Cold Blood, which, you know, everybody kind of quotes as the great first kind of true crime sort of story that was adapted into a feature. And yeah, like, I think that the cinematography, the production design, the costuming, The look and feel of the film adds this interesting sort of timeless quality that I wonder, because we're looking at it from the point of view of 2021, where we can appreciate it, and it's gone through the decades of being sort of vetted and reappraised and what have you. But I wonder, when it was released in 1955, if maybe it didn't get its due then, because I do feel as though some of the style and the aesthetic maybe would have been considered old hat by then, in the way that, like, now we're getting a lot of filmmakers who are, you know, grew up in the 1970s and 80s and are kind of bringing that aesthetic back, where you're kind of feeling like, okay, we're getting oversaturated here with, right, you know, that style. But then maybe 20, 30 years from now, those movies, like, I'm even thinking of like something like that just turned 10 years old, which, like, Drive, Nicholas Winding Refn's Drive, where again, that movie is very stylized and paying, yes, tribute to a lot of films of, you know, the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
But now we've gotten so many of those kind of films in the last decade or so that, you know, we're moving into, you know, 80s and 90s nostalgia, where I feel, because Charles Laughton also was a guy who kind of, you know, was an actor first, came into the industry as a silent movie star, you know, was a theater guy, won an Oscar. So he's taking those influences that he grew up with, that he saw on the set, and he's applying them there. And by the time you get to 1955, I do wonder if maybe audiences kind of felt like, oh, this is just something I've already seen before.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say, because I remember reading this years ago, and I checked again today, but it was a critical and box office flop. And apparently a large part of the reason, and you probably know this, that he didn't direct again because it did so badly. And it wasn't until years later that it got this cult following. Of course, Criterion Collection have released it. Guillermo del Toro is, you know, praises it left and right as a major influence on his work, and you can certainly see that with him, with his, you know, he's very much interested in fairy tales, but it's really is emotional and powerful, and at the same time I really like the psychology behind the characters. Even with the children, you see the confusion that happens to them, where their loyalty lies in terms of parenting. I mean, it's so clear at the end that when he sees Mitchum getting arrested, that reminds him totally of his father. And he, you know, goes to try to stop the police. It's bringing him back to that memory. And it happens so, so briefly. As soon as Mitchum finds them towards the end, and he's talking to Lillian Gish on the porch, and the kids come, you see the little girl runs towards him for a hug. And it's so brief. I can't recall seeing that the first time. And I thought, you know what, that's so true. I can see that they would be confused, that they would still crave that father figure that has not been there. And even this psychopath is, you know, or I mean, maybe you could see that as because he's like the devil, right? And he's able to seduce even just being there in his presence. But I think it's a little more complicated than that. I mean, how did those moments sit with you?
Yeah, I found them to be quite disturbing, but also the psychology of it is there. And to your point, you mentioned this earlier, where, you know, you have John, who probably will always have some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder, yeah, because of this, because he's old enough and impressionable enough to remember this. And you see that when he's throwing the money on Robert Mitchum, right, when he's, you know, on his stomach being arrested. But then you look at sort of the relationship and the dynamic of him having to be the grown-up in the situation,
yes, that's right,
and
yeah,
look after Pearl, who is being sort of basically swayed onto Robert Mitchum's side, and sort of seeing him as the replacement father figure in their life, to the point where when you see him on that porch again at the end, as you mentioned, you get this feeling that, like, she's recognizing something familiar. You know, she's seeing someone that she knows from her home. And even though he was abusive towards her, you know, in the parlor, in that one scene where, yeah, you know, Shelley Winters comes home and is basically looking at the window, and she hears, you know, Robert Mitchum asking where the money is, because he continually asks the kids behind, you know, her back, Willa's back.
Yes.
With those moments, you can see that there is this sort of abusive relationship being formed where the child, even though, you know, has been verbally and physically abused, is willing to come back to mm-hmm. the person that she is probably most comfortable with, or at least is still knows is there. And I find that that's kind of interesting as well. And even the way that, you know, we see this abusive relationship between Shelley Winters and Robert Mitchum, you know, on their honeymoon. I think that that scene
yeah.
is so disturbing
yeah.
and it's mostly just verbal. And the way that he basically degrades her, this whole film, rewatching it, like, you know, there's a lot of people that have a sort of a reprehension when it comes to black and white movies that were made, you know, of a time. But this is one of those films that while watching it, it has this contemporary feel to it still. Like, I feel like you could recommend this to anybody, not just because of the running time and not just because of the pacing, but it does have a lot of elements that feel contemporary to filmmaking mm-hmm. now, especially when it comes to genre filmmaking.
Right.
And again, we've seen it recycled throughout, you know, the decades. Like, there was a period in the early 90s where you were getting a lot of neo-noirs, you know, whether it be
Jim
Thompson adaptations of, like, you know, After Dark, My Sweet, or yeah. Red Rock West, or, you know, even Blue Velvet in the late 80s. So you were getting a lot of these sort of almost hard-boiled, you know, pulpy-esque stories that were very much, you know, of the same cut from the same cloth of The Night of the Hunter. And, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, there movies like this stand the test of time because they're so pure in what they're trying to do. And I think that it's just fascinating that you, again, we look at it now and we see it as a great movie. But it's just fascinating to think that, like, you know, an audience when it was being released that maybe didn't see it that way and just yeah. saw it as kind of a typical throaway genre movie
right.
that, you know, had a big movie star in it, obviously. And I kept thinking, like, okay, who would be the equivalent of Robert Mitchum today if you were to remake it or do something in the same vein?
It's like Bradley Cooper or someone.
I was going to think Michael Shannon.
Yeah. Michael Shannon, yeah.
Like, just like for that sure. imposing.
Oh, that's someone that's like Mitchum. So I thought, yeah. Like, oh, for sure, yeah.
That intensity. It's
so funny you said that. I was thinking the exact same thing, that I could totally see Michael Shannon playing this part today. No, you're absolutely right. No, you know, that's really good points. And I could see that as well, because it's so... I wonder if audiences today maybe gravitate towards a more of a stylistic film as opposed to at that time when, you know, in the 50s, there certainly still were some classic film noirs, but things were becoming more and more realistic. Even the performances, Marlon Brando, James Dean, Montgomery Clift, Shelley Winters, who's, you know, from that same school of acting,
The method acting, right?
Yeah, things were becoming more closer to life, which are the films that I are mostly my favorites. But I love these expressionistic fairy tale stories as well. And that scene you mentioned with Shelley Winters, to me, that was the most fascinating part of this film, the relationship with Mitchum and Winters, because as the husband says, early on, when he gives John the money, don't tell your mother because she doesn't have any common sense and you can just hide it. And when you're older, it's yours. You see that, unfortunately, that she is gullible and she's not the only one. I mean, it's like an innocent Christian town of people who are not educated. And Mitchum, I don't know if he necessarily knows. Well, I guess he does knows that they're not the brightest, even though he is also religious. It's hard to say how conscious or calculated he is in terms of being able to get what he wants from them, because in that honeymoon scene when she clearly wants to have sex and right away, you know, he makes her feel guilty that she even wants to do that, that's purely for childbirth, and how dare you, and you're, you know, as you said, degrades her, and of course, that guilt comes in and she totally believes him, even in that church scene afterwards where they have like fire everywhere and she's giving this speech that the preacher is
restoring, and she's wearing the cardigan too, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's I know what you mean. It's like oh my God, he's not doing this and she's not falling for it, but she is, even seeing that it was true that this guy is after the money right before he kills her, and still, well, that's okay because I know you're here for a bigger purpose. And sure enough, boom, you know, he stabs her, and it's so creepy. And it's you know, even, you know, you see him with his hand up, obviously that's the hate is taking over him in that moment, and the love is getting beat to shreds and defeated. And just visually, it works emotionally and visually. I felt so on such a lyric, so beautifully, that I just thought it was just brilliant. I just love those moments. I'm curious what you thought in terms of, you know, of course, that shot where she's dead under the water in the river. It's so spooky, that mannequin who she's still upright, and with the hair waving and everything. It's so creepy. And when the uncle finds her, he is alone saying, I can't tell anyone because I'm gonna get blamed. That was something I thought was a little odd. I don't know if that struck you as why he may have felt that way. Did you have any thoughts on that?
I guess, you know, maybe just in terms of like a time of when police investigation would probably be quick to sort of, you know, pin it on a suspect that, you know, maybe has priors. I would assume
that's what I thought.
Uncle Birdie might be somebody who has a sort of questionable background and maybe has a criminal record, and, you know, being of lower class, might have had troubles with the law in the past. And so something like this, you know, discovering it, who are you, you know, Robert Mitchum even has a line earlier on when he's talking to John. Oh, pardon me, I have dogs. So they just heard something, but maybe they heard Robert Mitchum at the door.
It's the Wolfman.
Yeah. So Robert Mitchum, you know, his character is talking to John, and there's a moment where it's like, okay, it's my word against yours. And I was thinking about that as well, where it's like, who would you rather believe, you know, a riffraff, you know, boatman who lives on the side of a river in a shack, or are you going to believe an upstanding, you know, clergyman?
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I mean, like, one thing I did kind of find a little bit jarring, was the end after Mitchum has been apprehended, and we kind of basically go back to the beginning where you have John again, you know, experiencing post-traumatic stress and just wants to be out of the situation, and not sort of pointing to Harry as the one who was the murderer. But when you have the mob sort of basically being cultivated, it almost feels like the mob is going after John.
They totally were, right? And that.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, they're still seduced by the devil. And what I love so much about that ending is that it seems like a happy ending, but at the end of the day, they're still in an environment where now everyone is against them. So what does that mean for them? Does that, even though this guy's in jail, you know, is he gonna get out? Is the Wolfman gonna come back? It's obviously, there's optimism in it. You know, they found love, they found a new family. Lillian Gish, you know, she talks about losing her son, and the orphans are now her children. But is it as happy as it seems? I don't know what you think.
I think it's a cynical ending. It does have a little bit of that kind of Douglas Sirks kind of ending where, you know, it's presented as a happy ending. There's a bit of kind of a moment of, oh, you know, the giving of the apple is finally John opening up to somebody and being able to, you know, share his vulnerabilities. And we even saw that when he asks Lillian Gish to you know, tell the same story again. And we're seeing that he's able to confide in an adult.
He puts his hand on her hand. I really like that.
It's a really lovely moment. Yeah. And I think, like, it's a strange ending as well when it comes to being happy, because at the beginning of this, when we saw, you know, after, even though we don't see Ben Harper, you know, be hung, we do see the warden, you know, coming home to his children, washing his hands before dinner, saying like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. It's taking a toll on me. But then when he's walking, you know, out of his home or out of the prison office, he's looking forward to seeing Harry get hung. Like, this is like, you know, this is going to be like his extra Christmas gift. Yeah. And it's such a weird sort of tonally jarring sort of thing to kind of introduce right before you have your sort of big Christmas moment at the end. And it's just funny thinking that, you know, you could watch this movie on Halloween and sort of, you know, end Halloween or one season with, you know, a scary movie and get ready for the holiday season with, you know, where it ends. But there's also just some really great lines in this movie as well. Like, I think about, like, you know, there's a line that Lillian Gish has after this owl comes and grabs grabs this rabbit and says, you know, it's a hard world out there for little things. And there's a line that Robert Mitchum has in the prison, you know, after, you know, having been arrested initially for auto theft, and he's talking to Ben Harper about, you know, basically that he lives in a world where, you know, short-term sort of religion is where, you know, you gotta go, because like everybody at the last minute is like becomes religious again. Right. And like those kind of things and those metaphors and meanings have so much going on in them. And I think that that's sort of really some great stuff in terms of just dialogue and just the snappiness of it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, because they really pop those moments. And I think that they were full of a feeling, even though sometimes I have mixed feelings about metaphors, because they can be they're shortcuts to the emotion, but sometimes they're so good and they work so beautifully and with a combination of a really emotionally charged story, like in my view this film has, I thought it worked so well. I don't know how you feel. This might be an obvious sort of no, but at one point when as I'm watching the film, I'm like, is this an anti-religious film, or is it just really the conflicts between love and hate, and that these people happen to use religion, find hate in religion but find love in it? I mean, I don't know how you felt about that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, again, cynical when it comes to, you know, certain people using religious rhetoric for their own gain,
which of course happens all the time, even now.
Yeah, and in the world, I mean, just in general, you know, there's the idea of practicing what you preach, and the idea of, you know, doing something that benefits other people and the community and yourself, and whether or not it is religious or you just want to do something to better, you know, others or yourself. This movie shows you how people can take that and basically manipulate others into doing their bidding, or, you know, be a charlatan. And I think that it is taking a stance of that Christianity, specifically in this storyline, because Robert Mitchum, you know, doesn't even subscribe to any specific religion. It's just whatever suits him or what's tailored to his own personal needs, instead of the needs of others. So I do think that it does have a very cynical point of view. But then again, you see with Gish's character, somebody who in all other movies would be a stereotype similar to Robert Mitchum, who uses it to maybe abuse the children in a foster home situation.
Right.
And, you know, where on the other hand, it's more refreshing because she is much more kind and sympathetic, even to Ruby, when, you know, she is going out and sort of, you know, dating boys instead of going to sewing lessons. You know, you see this moment where she tells Gish character this, and in that moment, instead of, you know, being scorned, you see this true sympathy come out. And it's this kindness that in a lot of other movies would have not been there for a character like that. So there, I do think it is taking it from the point of view that, you know, religion is a very dangerous tool for some people. But then again, you have somebody at the end that is using it you know, in a way that is bettering children's lives that, you know, have nowhere else to go.
I totally agree. And it makes it, as you were talking about how contemporary audiences can perceive this now. And to me, the best films are the ones that are relevant towards our everyday life. And certainly that theme alone is completely relevant. And this is a film that, it's like anything else. Like, you know, people can be hearing about like the residential schools right now for a moment. And if they're Catholic, it may be hard to them to accept what they're hearing. And maybe they block it out and they still go on ignoring what has the atrocities that have happened. And I think this is a great film to see because it's like, look, we're not saying get rid of the religion because these people used it in an evil way. Whereas, you know, I think it's so much more, like you said, that, you know, some people use it as it's an evil tool, but certainly blocking it out and ignoring it is not the way to go.
It's a very complicated issue to talk about because, again, like, I think it ultimately falls on the individual and how a person sort of approaches religion. If you use it to find comfort or to help others or, you know, do good, and as long as you're not hurting anybody, I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. But there also needs to be accountability, you know, in the world. And
absolutely,
you can't, you know, just look away from things that are going on, whether it be, you know, what's going on in, you know, the Middle East right now as well. Like, it's just one of those situations where, like, there's never going to be an answer that is going to satisfy everybody. But in terms of looking at it from the individual point of view, and specifically Robert Mitchum's character, he's justifying his actions by using religion as a way to, you know, be his get out of jail free card, to say that, you know, I'm not sinning because I'm ultimately doing, you know, the Lord's work, and the Lord in his world is just a version of him. You know, he's a self-centered, self-loathing monster. He's still human. I don't want to, like, he's not a supernatural force, but there are times where he does feel that way.
Yeah.
But ultimately he, you know, at the end of the movie, he's a pathetic small man who, you know, finally gets his comeuppance. And when he does, you know, you kind of do cheer in that moment, but ultimately the damage has been done on these two kids, especially John, who I don't think will ever be able to completely get over what he has experienced, where I think Pearl will still have that damage, but maybe she's young enough to forget some of it. And it's just really fascinating with the psychology of this movie as well, in terms of getting into the headspace of these kids and seeing it from their point of view, and how I think the style reflects that perfectly.
Oh, no doubt. Absolutely. And, you know, I don't think there can be, I don't think enough can be said about how great, in my view, the performances were by not just Shelley Winters, Mitchum, and Gish, but the children, Billy Chapin as John, particularly just his stillness, just his, how neutral he looked in terms of the way he looked at Mitchum with such distrust. I thought he was had a stillness and a sense of courage that I thought was essential for that part. And Sally Jane Bruce as Pearl, I loved as well. I was just reading earlier that apparently Lawden had a harder time with Sally Jane Bruce as opposed to Billy Chapin. And I haven't seen that, like, there's a two-hour documentary on them on set and him directing. It's on the Criterion DVD or Blu-ray. I don't know if have you ever seen that? Or
I did when I first bought the Blu-ray. And I mean, the old saying is, you know, the two people in Hollywood that you should never work with are children and animals, you know. And sometimes you get, Billy Chapin is fascinating to me because he went on to have a longer career where, you know, you have Sally Jane Bruce, who this is basically it for her in terms of acting.
I didn't know that. So this was all she did?
Where you know, Billy Chapin did more television and bit roles after this, but not too much more. He died at I think he was 72 when he passed away, but he didn't have like a long-term career either, but a little bit longer.
Not that long ago. 5 years ago. Yeah.
But what I like about his performance and the way that Charles Laughton directed him is that he does feel like he has to grow up significantly throughout the course of the film, but he does so in a way that never feels too precocious.
Right.
That feels too much like, you know, a classic child actor going from like maybe, you know, advertisements to a feature. He feels very natural, even when
Absolutely. He's,
you know, drinking the coffee with Uncle Bertie, which is a very kind of grown up moment where it's like, you know, two guys right before they go to work.
Right. I didn't even catch that. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a loss of innocence. Right. And he captured that, I felt. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just strange to think like a child his age drinking coffee in the morning. It's just bizarre. But again, I love those little idiosyncratic moments that are in the movie. And I love, like, even, you know, Shelley Winter's employers, the Spoons, you know, and them kind of being suckered in by Mitchum and just kind of, you know, Mrs. Spoon talking about her fudge and stuff like that. Like, it's just, there is some moments of levity throughout, yeah. even if it is a little bit darker in its approach.
I know, absolutely. I totally agree. And I think it's certainly a film. Again, it's not necessarily a complicated film, but I think there, with each viewing, there's more and more to see. Because as I said, this is only my second viewing, and it felt like a new movie to me. Like, I felt like I remembered certain things about it, but a lot of it, I watched it in a bad time or something, but. I thought it was a wonderful film, and I'm certainly going to get the Criterion, because it's got tons of featurettes, including that documentary I mentioned. Was there anything else you wanted to mention about this film?
Yeah, I just want to quickly, you know, reiterate that this is a hard movie to really pin down. And again, thinking about rewatching it, there was another movie I saw at TIFF this year that it's not, you know, thematically the same in any way, but Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog has a similar, it's chapter based in its structure, but in terms of what you're thinking it is and what it ultimately becomes are two different things. Right. So you look at The Night of the Hunter and you think, oh, am I going to get a film noir or horror movie? But right. then you start breaking it down and you see that it's a latchkey kid in peril movie, that it's, you know, no, it's sort of a morbid sort of dark comedy at times. It's also an expressionistic German-esque kind of aesthetically pleasing kind of film, as you mentioned as well. It's a Grimm's fairy tale. It's all these things in there, and that's kind of what it reminded me with The Power of the Dog, where everybody going into that movie thought, okay, we're gonna get, like, you know, a Western, and it's a deconstruction of that, but also there's a lot of thriller elements in there, and there's things that when you first watch it, you kind of look back and you're like, huh, that wasn't exactly what I expected it to be and what I was kind of basically putting it in a box as. And I might have been a little bit disappointed by that, but then you start thinking about it more and more and ultimately where it goes. And then you're like, no, this is really rewarding, because it kind of zigs when it should zag, and it does things in the film that you're not expecting it to. And that's why I think, again, a movie like The Power of the Dog and The Night of the Hunter are films where, if you have these preconceived notions going in and you project those onto them, you might be disappointed, but the more you think about it, the more you come to appreciate that it doesn't do what you're expecting it to, and it's doing its own thing. And it's so rewarding because there are so many layers to what this film has to offer. And I think that's why people have been rediscovering it over the decades and sort of reappraising it as a masterpiece. And again, it's just a shame that Charles Laughton didn't get a chance to direct anything else.
I agree.
And looking at genre too, I think genre is also another key sort of aspect of this film, is that it's easy to dismiss anything that is horror or thriller adjacent or related. I mean, we've gotten into this day and age where we have to call things elevated horror in order to sell it to mainstream audiences. It's just a shame that we can't embrace horror movies that we do in the same way that we do, you know, dramas or international films. And, you know, there are very few movies that do that. And I think something like Parasite recently is a film that kind of, like, broke that mold, saying, no, a genre movie doesn't have to come every 10, 15 years and be quote unquote elevated in order to win awards and be, you know, critically acclaimed. It can do all these things at once and be more than what it's defined as.
Right. Yeah, no, very, very well said. And, you know, as someone who's never been much of a horror fan, but doing this podcast and having on different guests, I used to have a co-host on this show as well. And he was a huge horror fan. And I never really agreed with that view, that I just thought, you know, genre didn't necessarily, I mean, they're good stories and maybe good films, well made, but didn't necessarily have value in terms of great art or something that you can learn about that would help your life or what life can be. But I've been proven wrong on on many occasions, and this is certainly one of them. So I think if anyone hasn't seen it, I highly recommend it. It's not on the Criterion channel anymore, but it, you know, they come and go on there. I'm sure it'll come back, but you can get the Blu-ray or DVD. And if this is your first time here on my channel, I also have a Patreon membership, and the link is in the description box below. I have a tier which is dedicated to film noir as well as movies from all over the world. So you can check it out in the description box below. There's also an audio version of this podcast. You can get it anywhere that has any platform, basically Spotify, Amazon, Apple, it's everywhere. And if this is your first time here, please consider subscribing by pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it floating above my head to your top left in just a second. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video or when I go live. So Eric, thanks again. I really appreciate that you came on. I talk so passionately about this film. I really enjoyed your insight, and I hope to have you on again really soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm glad that we got to talk a little bit about a genre movie that kind of defines categorization, and a great movie for anybody that is looking for something to watch during the October month in terms of horror films.
No, I absolutely agree. And where can people find you online?
Yeah, so you can find me. I have video reviews on rogerstv.com/cinemascene and on the social medias at EM6211. I'm also the co-host of the Untitled Movie Podcast, which you can also find on all iTunes and other sort of podcast hosts and things like that. So yeah. I'm out there.
Perfect. Great. Well, I'll put those links in the description box below if you want to go check out Eric's content. And thanks so much, everyone. I'll see you in the next video.